In 1973, a group of indigenous artists formed a collective. The press called them the Indian Group of Seven. Their goal? To raise the profile of indigenous art.
That was all or nothing. We're representing all our people.
And create a permanent space in galleries for indigenous artists in Canada and around the world.
That was really a rock star moment for me.
I'm Soleil Launière, and this is Among Equals, the history and legacy of the Professional Native Indian Artists, Inc. Listen wherever podcasts are heard.
Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. During Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, La Catrina can be seen among the marigolds, papel picado, candles, and altars, inviting lost loved ones to visit us once again. Her image has transcended borders, and to much of the world, she's become one of the most popular folk icons of Mexico, synonymous with Sugar Skulls, Frida Kahlo, Coco, or even La Virgen de Guadalupe. But the truth behind those bedroom eyes.
I would say so.
And that big toothy grin. La Catrina is following a tradition of honoring mortality that goes back to ancient Greece and the Aztec Empire, but she also came to represent more than just death. She was a satirical response to the lingering grip of colonialism, which fanned the flames of the Mexican Revolution, eventually becoming the voice of the working class.
She sparked an art museum riot and inspired a generation of big-boyed, tiny glass assist muralists, and while she is kind of doofusy looking, yes, it makes her relatable and approachable. And I find that very endearing. She's a skull for the people, if you will, living or dead. And we're taking a big leap here, might be reflected in the rising popularity of the renegade saint, Santa Muerte. I did just say Saint Muerte, and I probably didn't say Muerte right. Just to get over. She's great. She's a double saint. Double saint. Welcome to Art Slice. Use your bones. Use your fingy bones. Smash the like and subscribe. Crush the bone. Crush your bones. Crush your bones on the keys, on the clickers. Do the thing. It's Art Slice.
Okay.
It's Art Slice. We're back, baby.
We're back, baby.
It's Art Slice.
Stephanie Duenas. This is Russell Shoemaker. He is on assignment and en una televisión. Welcome to a very Halloween, very Día de los Muertos episode of Art Slice. We're covering all of our bases, the pumpkin spice faction, the Celtic haunting spirit faction, the journey through Mictlan faction, but we're going to start with the skull faction because when you get down to it, down to the bones of it, La Catrina is just an image of a cute, kind of doofusy looking skull, but hers wasn't the first. To many Mesoamerican cultures, human bones were imbued with transcending energy and power. And thus, they were collected. They were chiseled into stone. And you can find them both real and rendered in Aztec, Maya, Mixtec, Toltec, and probably many other temples and monuments. The bones were sometimes of captives or losers of that racquetball-esque Mesoamerican ballgame, which were collected shortly after human sacrifices. Their bones were the ultimate symbol of gratitude. Speaking of bonage, the skull portion of the overall bonage of los huesos were reserved for the tzompantli, or the skull rack, which could hold tens of thousands of them, all appeasing the god's thirst for blood and ensuring the balance of the universe and a prosperous harvest. The most accessible Tzompantli can be seen at the Aztec Templo Mayor, smack dab in the middle of the historic center of Mexico City, or in the remote Mayan Chichen Itza. For the Aztec and Maya, death wasn't an end, but part of a cycle.
And while you might have not wanted to get ritualistically sacrificed, at least it was for something practical, like ensuring the, you know, whatever you said, the balance of the harvest and the prosperous universe and whatnot. Not to just be the topic of some sophist's musings somewhere in Europe and or Greece, where since ancient times, skulls symbolized something a bit different, but also kind of the same thing, Memento mori, the grim reminder of your own mortality, literally translating to do fear the reaper, or at least try to remember the reaper, or live like you were dying by Tim McGraw, who might be dead. Is he dead?
No.
He's dead, right?
I think he
did. Was he the one who died? And that level of deep understanding of our finite existence can now only be unlocked by listening to like a true crime podcast while maybe folding your laundry in a studio apartment in front of a live, love, laugh, live, love, laugh sign, live, love, laugh. A word salad so specific that I could find no stock footage, nor could AI handle the depths of its profundity.
While Aztec designers were stacking skulls and chiseling skellies on walls, ancient Egypt allegedly. Banquets featuring human skeleton centerpieces. Mm-hmm. Buddhists and Greek Stoics took their either meditative or contemplative time to spiral and ruminate on life and entropy and mortal coils.
Like the soul, right? Like if there even is a soul, I guess there'd be some like sort of difference in the theories between the two. But like, is the whatever you call the soul, whatever you equate to the soul, is it like fleeting? Is it part of like a greater life cycle? Like how like, you know, a leaf falls to the ground and entropies into the ground and then, you know, goes into the ground and becomes, you know, food for the tree that sprouts from the ground to create another leaf. Is my soul doing that as well? Like, does my soul pass on to whatever the soul is? You know, I'm not going to argue. I'm not here to argue about souls. Like, does it pass on to the non-material existence and then become part of the like non-material like entropy, right? Like, will my soul become a wave of sound that one day emanates from the data on a compact disc CD, maybe a Tim McGraw CD, who knows? And if he's even still alive, and am I wasting my life trying to figure this out as a sophist? Or if I'm a Buddhist, am I a bad Buddhist because I'm thinking about these things when I should be thinking about nothing?
But luckily, the invent of Christianity came along, introduced lots of rules like heaven and hell, and that whole memento mori thing took a more judgy stance.
Right.
The Roman Catholic Church, RC Squared, found that commissioning artists to visualize this helped to keep the rubes in line and, bonus, to fill their coffers.
Okay. Bernini, the dynamic Italian Baroquist, while chiseling a funerary monument to Pope Alexander VII, I think that's seven, snuck in a gilded winged skeleton caught in a heavy swath of marbled fabric. Yet triumphantly holding up his bonered hourglass above the fabric riptide.
If el Papa se puede morir, you too. You too.
You too. Yeah. Hans Holbein, the Youngerer, Northern Renaissance artist, reminded us all that he would not be the Youngerer foreverer. In his 1533 painting, The Ambassadors, showing two courtly learned fellows who had filled their lives with the pursuits of exploration, adventure, the arts, the sciences, or at least they had the possessions that would, you know, lead a date to think that. All of that was perfectly, and I mean perfectly, rendered by younger Hans, except for the weird, plopped on, like, Dolly-esque, skewed aspect ratio thing.
If viewed from the front, if you happen to shift your perspective, you get a jump scare. Jump scare.
Just this like metal as fuck magic eye skull just like sliding through like time and space like a knife through butter. Just like, why did he do this?
Aztec meets Spain. Spain meet Aztec. Despite the hundreds of years of brutal colonization by the Spanish, skull imagery or its pre-Hispanic meaning never left. Indigenous folks, motivated to survive but not yet ready to give up on their traditions, quietly blended their pre-Hispanic beliefs and meaning into the Catholicism that was forced upon them. Saint Isidore, the patron saint of farmers, subbed in for Tlaloc, an important Aztec rain god. Tonantzin, the Aztec mother goddess, became La Virgen de Guadalupe. And, of course, in the merging of the Mesoamerican celebration of the dead, carrying in the use of ofrendas, calaveras, and marigolds with All Saints' Day, which was itself influenced by paganism, all of that became Día de los Muertos. 3 centuries later, Mexico won its independence from the Spanish, and President Porfirio Díaz came to power in 1876 to mixed reception. He had won the favor of many indigenous and working-class folk who were also fighting for their rights, and he even helped to fend off a second colonoscopy attempt.
Colonoscopy. Is it colonoscopy? You said you did a boner. That was a boner. That was a bona fide boner.
It says colonoscopy.
It does not say colonoscopy. Well, it does say colonoscopy, but it is a bona fide boner.
There's colon and colonization. Yeah. Okay.
Hey, you did a boner in the boner episode, and I want it recognized.
President Diaz quickly implemented authoritarianism and promoted himself to Presidente Dictator Diaz.
The elite class kept old Dickie D, Dictator Diaz, in power, and he in turn kept their pockets lined, right? Under his regime, Mexico did begin to modernize, but it happened at the expense of the working class, the wholesale of Mexico's territory, and natural resources to the USA baby, we love our minerals, deepening social inequality and widespread abuses. He would violently crush any naysayers, all while he wrapped himself in European first world luxuries.
A far cry from the Mexicano bad boy he was seen as just years earlier.
Heavy is the man who wears the mustache, the moustache.
Much like the 18th century Spanish royals that we covered in our Goya episodes, 19th century Mexicano upper crusties, the Dickie D ruling class, if you will, was obsessed with all things Franciness, as in from France, Francia, right? You know, like dressing like them,
French, yeah.
Speaking like them, frying like them, kissing like them, toasting like them, vanillaing like them. I think you get it, et cetera, et cetera.
Goya's print series Los Caprichos used grotesque visual humor to call out not only the injustices of the aristocracy, but the cyclical environment it both fostered and feasted upon. A century later, Mexican printmaker and lithographer Jose Guadalupe Posada would use a similar visual language to protest the inequality Diaz's ruling class had created for their own benefit, right? Keeping the population undereducated, illiterate, and penniless.
Jose Guadalupe Posada was born in 1852 in Aguascalientes, to a working-class family of bakers. Going against the baker path, he discovered his talent for illustrating complex graving and lithography as a teen. His work would first turn heads on the pages of the local newspaper, El Jicote, the Bumblebee, where his satirical prints looked like they borrowed from Los Caprichos' use of visual wordplay, spooky imagery, hybrid animal dupicicis, with depictions of players in the Diaz regime, which got the Bumblebee shut down after only 11 issues. Word on the street was a certain political figure had been offended. Eventually, Jose would open up his own workshop in Mexico City, and his friends would come to call him Don Lupe, which is what we're going to call because we like that casual friend vib around these parts.
Or friendly.
Friendly. Friendly Mabley.
Or friendly Mabley.
Yes, yes, we love it. Don Lupe would open his own workshop in Mexico City, substituting calaveras, meaning characters of skulls and bones, for the ruling elite, the wealthy, the corrupt, and for all those living in the chaos they create. In this way, his prints could more openly criticize life under Diaz's rule.
These prints, called penny papers or broadsides, were printed cheaply on one-sided, often brightly colored paper, allowing them to be pasted on walls and to be spotted on walls because of the brightly colored paper. They usually reported the news, announcements, and even maybe a little bit of revolutionary editorializing. The literacy rate for adults at this time was maybe 32%, maybe a little bit lower in the areas that these broadsides were the most popular. So they couldn't just rely on the text alone to tell the story.
This is where Don Lupe's Goya-like ability lets him illustrate those complex sentiments.
In easy-to-understand, like, darkly humorous and eye-catching ways. And this became crucial to win over minds to the budding Mexican Revolution against one Señor Presidente Diaz.
Don Lupe created hundreds of calaveras, playing guitar, dancing, riding bikes, being run over by trolley carts, and even walking around with bowl cuts. This one right here, this one guy, aquí. In La Calavera Oaxaqueña, or Oaxaca Calavera from 1900, depending on which broadside you see, it could be calaveras del montón or calaveras from the heap.
Giant-headed and sombrero-adorned, this calavera's hypnotic stare and his bedazzled charro suit distracts you from his bloody speed run through a heap of skulls. Skulls of varying societal class structures, too. See, notice the top hat over here somewhere. We get a sense that he is both liberator and liberator, as in liberator of the oppressed, or murderously liberating your soul from your mortal coil. Possibly a socialist anarchist Zapatista, possibly a Diaz fam hatchman covered in blood and Fago. Okay.
Okay. Fago. This Oaxacan-inspired fit, although at first a signifier of wealth, eventually became associated with the OG cowboys, the rancheros. And because regional cultures are on their own fluid timeline at this point, we would need like a semester or three of Mexican history to fully get the context here. But the turmoil is palpable and it still feels incredibly relevant to this day, which, by the way, if you have knowledge of the Mexican Revolution, we would love to know your take on this.
I love how Don Lupe pays special attention to the asymmetrical jaw and Invisalign teeth here. He does not give a fuck about Invisaligns, man. He's got like a revolution to either start or prevent. Either way, he's got people to kill. The buttless, crotchless twist of the pants there is just, it's just...
It's all bone, no thigh. All bone, no thigh.
Also, 20 teens ICP joke right here. The hatchet man. What? Magnets? How do they work? Right? Hatchet man? The Fago? Fago? I got the Fago can? I found one? You know, like melding cultural touchstones together. Okay. Guess I just wasted that Fago. All right.
In... In Calavera de los Patinadores, or Calavera of the Street Cleaners, this fellow is either having a swig from a jug or está dando un besito a la calavera, seemingly unbothered by the skeleton workforce behind him, with brooms held in the phalanx of both the poor and the wealthy. This is how I sweep now. This is how I sweep.
Yeah.
I sweep all the time. Calavera.
We actually have a robot vacuum. You don't sweep. We have a robot.
You know what? Oh. It can't get the corners, okay? It can't get the corners. Someone has to get the corners. All right. Back to these street cleaners. In Calavera of the Street Cleaners, Don Lupe illustrates death as the great equalizer. Security is having a good chuckle, even slapping the scapula of a fellow working class paisa, kind of as if to say, hey, check out that that top hat over there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your status on earth means nada in Mictlán. You're going to clean the streets with the rest of us forever. But you know what? Top hat, he's going to be okay. He's me okay. He's got a little wealthy pancita he's got to work off. But at least he got to keep his fancy, you know, tailor-made European clothes.
Actually, a decade later, there were efforts to reduce the power of the elite. I don't know. Maybe inspired by this prince here. Because it required them to perform manual labor, like street cleaning. A little bit of street cleaning. Mm. Today, though, it would just be like implemented into the larger like grind set mindset, YouTube sort of shit mentality, right? And they'd just be like selling you like broom, like weighted broom handles that track your, you know, your
steps,
your blood sugar levels or something. Like you gotta get injected into your vein. I don't know. Anyway, check out these fine details. Like you get the tiny fabric ripples. You get that sweeping motion there. That's just like engraved into the metal or the wood. You get the more impressionistic, vague details of the buildings as they fade off into the background. It's perfect. It's great.
On to Don Lupe's most famous calavera, the one we are all here for today, La Catrina. But actually, she was first known as Calavera Garbancera or the Chickpea Vendor. Yeah, this gal, she's got a big toothy grin. She's wearing a huge, almost umbrella-sized bougie hat with a giant-ass ostrich feather to match. A style that was really emblematic of that French Diaz drip.
A little hard on the neck. Oh, that whole bouquet of flowers she's wearing there.
Yeah, she's got no muscles to help her out with that.
Yeah, it's all bones.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're friendly.
Sure.
Amicable.
Yes. And
a skull you'd like to, you know, maybe go on a car ride with. She seems nice.
A friendly skull face.
Yeah, yeah.
To take it out to dinner for a nice stroll.
Yeah.
Nice stroll under the moonlight.
Hey, you going to finish that soup? It just goes right through.
Love okay. that. Okay. All right. So she was created around 1910 to 1912, and it was published on Day of the Dead in 1913. So once again, we don't know the exact intended meaning behind it because Don Lupe actually died a few months before it was published. However, the broadside caption read, Remate de calaveras alegres y sandungueras, las que hoy son empolvadas garbanceras, pararán en deformes calaveras.
Mm.
Or, the ending of the cheerful and sandunga dancing calaveras, those that today are powdered chickpea vendors, will end as deformed skulls. So this broadside caption requires some context. So corn, or maíz, was the staple indigenous ingredient in daily meals and one that Mesoamerican cultures had relied on for centuries. So much so that it plays an important role in the Mayan creation myth as seen in the Popol Vuh. But since colonization, the Spanish had introduced chickpeas or garbanzo beans and many vendors sold them. For tapas. Yes, exactly, for tapas.
Tapas.
And many vendors sold them, those European-minded Diaz followers being the primary customers. Working-class folks, often of indigenous ancestry, were more likely to have darker skin. But since lighter skin was associated with the upper class, many darker-skinned Mexican women would lighten their skin with powder and do their best to imitate that high-end Euro fashion.
Like those two foolish doofuses in Goya's Los Chinchillas, who wrapped themselves in an aristocratic coat of arms, shut their eyes and opened their mouths for some spoon-fed hopes and dreams from a guy in a chinchilla outfit. I'm not sure. Calavera Garbancera abandoned her own class struggle to pretend to be part of something that had like no interest in accepting her, all while given that big toothy grin, right? The big toothy friendly grin.
Don Lupe's work shows that regardless of social hierarchy, death, memento mori, is the great equalizer.
And you can read that as like, don't be foolish, support your class allies, and instead, you know, work for a better tomorrow. His calavera figures, playful, joyful, ignorant to their own struggle, really struck a chord with the public and played a very important revolutionary role, putting into visuals what words couldn't easily describe. While his images lived on, Calavera Garbancera specifically gained a cult following. Meanwhile, Don Lupe himself died penniless, probably full of tainted beer, and he was just totally forgotten to everyone, except for some true art/revolution weirdos, the Mexican muralists, who began to think of him as this prophetic figure.
After 10 years, the Mexican Revolution ends in 1920, and Mexico enters a new chapter now, okay? One of rebirth, embracing left-wing populism, implementing broad labor rights, redistribution, land reforms, making those top hats clean the streets. And there was a strong emphasis on bringing the entirety of Mexico up, wanting to educate people about their pre-Columbian roots and also instill in them a hope for the future. They invested in archaeology, technology, and notably, artology, which could educate and inspire hope in the masses and not just hang in some wealthy person's home. Enter the Mexican muralists who had all lived through the revolution and who had seen Don Lupe's broadsheets pasted on the walls. José Clemente Orozco described how formative Don Lupe's work was in his youth.
I just imagine little Jose, same baby mustache, same baby glasses, just a little mini-me version. Little guy, same guy, smaller. Same guy, smaller.
Small.
This is him here, this is him now. Just shrunk proportionally.
Quote, Posada used to work in full view behind the shop windows, and on my way to school and back, four times a day, I would stop and spend a few enchanted minutes watching him. Sometimes I even ventured to enter the shop and snatch up a bit of shavings that fell from the plate as a master's graver passed over it. This was the push that first set my imagination in motion and impelled me to cover paper with my earliest little figures. This was my awakening to the existence of the art of painting. End quote. In 1921, French artist with some Mexican ancestry, Jean Charlot, moves to Mexico City, where he would become involved in the blooming Mexican Renaissance. As un jeune garçon, his early exposure to Mexican art, manuscripts, and pre-Columbian artifacts inspired him to learn Nahuatl, language of the Mexica people who were part of the Aztec Empire. Jean was enamored with all of the calavera illustrations he saw around Mexico City. On his daily bolillo run, he would see calavera prints being sold on street corners, but he was unable to find out who the original artist was. Jean became determinado to solve el misterio. Eventually, he was able to track down Don Lupe's publisher's workshop and even found the original printing blocks. Meanwhile, in 1925, American transplant writer Frances Tour, later known as La Gringa Folclorista, started publishing Mexican Folkways, a popular bilingual magazine distributed in both Mexico and the U.S., with one Diego Rivera serving
big boy
as the art editor. There he is.
Our big baby boy.
You knew he was coming. Soon, Frances began featuring Don Lupe's work annually, featuring large reprints of his calaveras in the Day of the Dead issues. But for some reason, Katrina Garbancera was never among them. Mm. Eventually, Don Lupe's popularity grew, and they published a comprehensive collection of his work. Katrina Garbancera finally being included and was officially renamed from Calavera Garbancera to La Katrina, meaning female dandy. Katrina was actually a nickname in the early 20th century in Mexico for an elegant upper-class woman who dressed in European clothing, i.e. dandy boy, but girl, dandy gal.
Luckily for Mexican muralism, anyone could enjoy the murals too, dandies, non-dandies, dandies, non-binaries alike, and soon it would spread across the border. Throughout the 20s to 40s, Mexican muralists were incredibly popular, not just in Mexico, but in the USA, baby, Detroit, California, and
New York City.
And for good reason, like their murals are still legendary to this day. They inspired many WPA-funded artists to also join communist groups like artist unions. And Don Lupe's prophetic status among the muralists meant that the now defo 30-year-old Calavera himself was given a huge exhibition at the Art Institute of Chicago titled Posada, Printmaker to the Mexican People.
The exhibition opened in March of 1944, and there were like early aughts Black Friday style riots as over 6,000 people queued up to see the prints. Among the images of revolutionary carnage was the grinning La Catrina, who was now a bona fide smash hit, even gracing the cover of the exhibition catalog.
So now not only does Don Lupe garner this like mythical status, but Katrina is garnering her own. The most famous of the Mexican muralists, our big, beautiful boy himself, Diego Rivera, said of Don Lupe, quote, as great as Goya, Posada was a creator of inexhaustible wealth. No one will imitate him. No one will define him. His work is the work of art par excellence. Which, to be fair, does kind of sound like someone asked him for a quote on Posada, and he was just like, I like the guy, but hold on, let me think. No one will define him. But 3 years later, Diego Rivera would take his Katrina admiration further. So he did like the guy, okay? painting her as the central focal point of his massive mural.
Sueño de una tarde dominical en la Alameda Central.
Exactly. Dream of a Sunday afternoon in Alameda Park. Which we were just there in Alameda Park, and it was beautiful. I mean, there was a houseless person taking a shit behind a tree. Not exactly what Diego had dialed up, not exactly what he envisioned for the future of Mexico. But we did see a cute cat, too.
Yeah.
It basically illustrates the history of Mexico and all the players involved in the revolution. In the center, you can find Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, as a boy, for some reason. That reason is because he grew up in Alameda Park and actually lived through the revolution. So he envisioned it unfolding there. You can also find Don Lupe and Katrina herself, right smack dab in the center, all holding hands. It's a very sweet moment. Diego, ever the archaeology nerd and fanboy of cyclical cosmic connections, took it upon himself to embed new meaning into Katrina.
By adding to her fit, below the oversized big bougie hat, Diego has put her in a Tehuana skirt worn by the indigenous women from Tehuantepec, polar opposite of bourgeoisie. And it's also the same clothing that Frida chose to wear to symbolize the badass women of the revolution. Her belt hides the Olin glyph, which in Aztec cosmology represents the cyclical movement of nature, a connection to the myth where goddesses travel to the underworld to gather bones for a new birth, something echoed in Frida's yin and yang symbol. Around La Catrina's neck is what at first seems to be a regular feather boa, but is actually the feathered serpent god, Quetzalcoatl. And finally, because Diego has a special spot in his little corazón for the Aztec goddess, Coatlicue, finding ways to work her into his 1933 Detroit industry murals as a towering stamping press requiring human sacrifice. AKA, She of the Serpent Skirt now appears in the rattle on Katrina's boa. And she, like Katrina, also has fangs and a bloody mouth from all of those crunchy human sacrifices.
Diego loved him some dualism, and while the mural as a whole indicates the struggle for freedom, the sacrifice it requires is contrasted by the life that it brings.
Katrina herself now seems to have visible eyes peeking out from behind the skull, making her a figure both alive and dead.
Este mural fue pintado por Diego Rivera, famoso pintor mexicano.
Today, La Catrina is Don Lupe's most recognizable creation and has become the international icon of Day of the Dead, Mexico's annual fiesta to honor the deceased that takes place on November 1st and 2nd. From her beginnings as a humorous political figure on penny papers and broadsides, La Catrina has since become more palatable, and her visage can be found on anything from a coaster to a Halloween costume. She's giving the Virgen de Guadalupe, the revered Catholic saint, a run for her money. Speaking of, yet another female figure is rising in Mexican saint stardom, Santa Muerte, Saint Death, the Lady of Death. And unsurprisingly, she is not officially recognized by the Catholic Church. Yet, she is quickly becoming one of the most popular saints in the nation, as the world we live in seems to get grimmer and grimmer. Things for Mexico are looking up with the newly elected first female president, Claudia Sheinbaum. So we have La Virgen de Guadalupe, La Catrina, Claudia Sheinbaum, and Santa Muerte.
Yeah.
It's a good lineup. It's a good little group here. I'm actually kind of fascinated with this little lineup. You have myth, tangible creation, democratically voted, and then unofficially chosen by the people. They all represent a rising, a breaking of glass ceilings, mythical or metaphorical, if you will. A fun reminder of that memento mori and that death is the great equalizer.
And if you join our Patreon, we'll give you our theories on the whereabouts of old Timmy McGraw. If he's alive, if he's dead, if he's living like he was dying. And as a bonus, you'll be supporting education like we all know. Unlike the whereabouts of Tim McGraw, which is unknowable unless you join our Patreon, education should all, of course, put us all, deeply, deeply, deeply into debt. And in this case, in our case, it'll only be like a couple bucks, which is not as much in debt. So
use those phalanxes to and subscribe.
Thank you.
And subscribe. Thank you. Now I'm waving bye. for those of you listening with my phalanxes. Bye. Adios.
I've been here the whole time.